Hello, and welcome to the third of our occasional mini-series, as it were, the Ukraine Quarterly, which is a total misnomer. It does not, in fact, assess the developments in the current war in Ukraine 3 months at a time, which would be the obvious thing to do. But it is essentially a shortcut that allows us to step back from our usual approach and instead consider the process of history and how historians relate to current affairs in a way that we don't usually do in the main episodes for this podcast. The first one of these was done just a few months, I guess, or even weeks after the this invasion by Russia began. That was Charles and Alex, Charles S. Dale and Alexander Mika Baredze talking their way through their initial responses, really, to the invasion. A second episode followed early in 2023, when Alex and Charles were joined by Simon Sebag Montefiore, whose own work on Russia casts its own light on and perspectives on the invasion. And now here we are. This third episode was recorded right at the end of 2023 with Professor Emeritus Elise Wirtschafter. Now, regular listeners to the podcast might have heard Elise. I did an interview with her last summer or thereabouts. I think if you scroll back in the feed to June or July, you should be able to spot it. But this is the first time she's spoken to Alex Mika Baredze and, of course, Charles to talk through. I suppose it's not just about the invasion, but about the process of history, how history relates to things going on today, and just a general sense of, you know, working out the state of play when it comes to these difficult, tricky matters. Of course, these all three are historians of they're very well regarded in their respective fields. Elise is somebody who spent her whole career working on Russian history. She'd started off in the Cold War period, as you'll hear. Were actually travelling to Moscow to work through the archives in the 1980s. There was a set view, a Cold War mentality about Russia back then, but then everything changed for her, and those initial impressions she'd got were upended, and a new logic, a new approach became the norm. Of course, that approach has once again had to be torn up, and are we back where we started? Very possibly. Well, look, I'm actually recording this a few days after this recording took place. In fact, what happened was I did record an introduction then and handed over to Alex, but the quality on it is terrible, so I'm re-recording it now. So you'll see that there's a little bit of artifice when I nevertheless do attempt a simulated handover and hand over the microphone to the person who'll be chairing this discussion that you'll hear. I'll be stepping back from the microphone as I say, Alex, over to you.
Thank you, Alex. It is my really distinct honor and privilege to welcome Elise once again to the podcast. She's an eminent historian, as Alex pointed out, of Russian history. In fact, I've as a graduate student, I've read voraciously her works and learned quite a bit of what I know about Russian history from her research. She comes from, if you are into academic lineages, she comes from a very distinct one, because she studied under Mark Rafe, renowned historian of Russian history, and she defended her a doctorate under his supervision at Columbia University, focusing on the peasant soldiers in the Russian army, and really was first to examine the relationship between the imperial expansion, state building, training an army, and of course that notorious institution of serfdom, which she discussed in multiple books of And among her amazing, really, output, academic output, I would name From Serf to Russian Soldier. I think that's the book that was based on her doctorate. That was published back in 1990. And of course, the fundamental studies like Structures of Society, Social Identity in Imperial Russia. And one of my favorites, moving away kind of from military history, The Play of Ideas in the Russian Enlightenment Theater. So without further ado, Elise, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for your kind introduction. I appreciate it. And I'm glad to know at least you have read some of my books.
Oh,
we wonder these days, you know, if anyone's reading our books. So
I read it, I'm using it in my classes, especially your one of your most recent one. Maybe it is the most recent one, the study of Russian diplomacy in the 19th century. I've used it in my Russian history courses. I have enormous respect for you, but I do want to point out that you do have a flaw, you do have a weakness, and that is your support of a wrong American football team.
Oh, man, there you go. Roll Tide.
Yes, that's right. We'll have a separate discussion. How an eminent scholar like you can support a wrong team, but that's just for a separate episode. And of course, I want to start our conversation with a big picture question, maybe, and that is what, and then us being both in the world of academia, how do you see this ongoing conflict impacting the field of Russian history or the Russian studies, both United States and abroad, because I think there is a profound need to reevaluate where we stand as historians of Russian state, of Russian society. What are your thoughts?
Well, I completely agree with that formulation. And, the first question and the easier one has to do with practical matters, and that would be access to sources. I mean, we have at least one, maybe two generations of scholars who have grown up, so to speak, been formed at a time when access to archives and to Russian society and Russian scholars seemed free and open. And, you know, no one ever expected that would end or thought that would end. But those of us who go back to the Soviet era, you know, where things were much more difficult and touch and go, we've had the experience of being controlled in our access to archives and sources, and especially in our access to other scholars working in Russia. You know, so I mean, as someone who went to the Soviet Union for the first time in 1980 and who was fortunate enough to be granted access to archives, including military archives, which was unusual at that time, I appreciate what people are facing now and the uncertainty they're facing. And I'm not sure how to deal with it at this point, because we had an exchange, you know, back in the Soviet era, there were official exchanges and there were ways to go. Not everyone got to. And then, as I said, you were controlled when you got there, but there were exchanges. So now there's nothing, you know, there are no exchanges. Some people may go as individuals, but that's an iffy prospect. So one thing people need to think about is how to study Russia, you know, without going to archives in Russia and without having those free interactions with Russian scholars. And of course, one way that people are doing this is by going to some of the newly independent countries that were part of the Soviet Union and that have Russian archives. So that's one, you know, that's a practical area. I could go on and on about it, but I'll stop. And then the second question is, well, there's a moral question in terms of you know, to what extent do we accommodate ourselves to this new Putin system, which is something we actually did in Soviet times, and we didn't think much about it as a moral question. We thought about it as, you know, we need to, it's important for national security for Americans to understand something about Russia, and this is what we're doing. You know, even if in order to do that, we have to accommodate ourselves to the Soviet system and choose topics that the Soviet system will accept if we want to get access to archives. So all of those, you know, questionable moral practices are again in play. And this time, you know, I think there's an added question of which questions are we asking, how are we formulating our questions? And I think that that's where we need to have some serious discussions and really do some rethinking. And the good news is that we have several generations of scholars with different perspectives who can put their heads together and think about these questions. But of course, it's hard when people are invested in their books that they've already written. It's hard to rethink or reevaluate, you know, what you've already said or already thought you knew. So, you know, I think that the current situation has really shown us how little we know about Russia, how little we understand Russia. And that's, you know, that's what I'm thinking about now. And I actually have been wondering about that question since Putin came to power. And we should have been thinking about it already in the Yeltsin era, because things already, if you look back, were changing, or they never got to where we thought they were going or where we thought they might be going. So it's definitely a difficult moment for the field.
Yeah, and kind of speaking from my personal experiences, I had a project that I wanted to examine kind of as my next book, and I got denied access to the Russian archives. I wanted to do the Foreign Ministry archives.
When was that?
Right, in the spring of 2022. Twice. One in 2021, I got denied, and then I submitted in right as the war was. Broke out in that spring. I had submitted, so I got denied again. So what I did is essentially I'm moving away from the Russian centered kind of research, the original research, mm-hmm. because I have some materials from the military archives from the previous projects that I can still mine, but there will be nothing new that I will probably lay my hands on for years to come. And that's, of course, is the problem for the graduate students as well. So I have a student who is working on PhD, and he just finished master's last year, and he wanted to pursue a PhD in Russian history. So I've told him that he will not be probably able to visit Russian archives in a while. So both he and me, we are now switching to, as you rightly pointed out, to the topics that will be kind of dealing with the Russian history, but looking from a different point of view. So both of us are looking now at the Caucasian history, so history of Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan. So he's now working on a PhD to discuss or examine the institution of viceroyalty that of course, Russians set up in the Caucasus, which will allow him to use the local archives without necessarily having direct access to the imperial archives in Russia. So that is a profound challenge indeed. And of course, I think one of the biggest issues I had when I came to United States and kind of dived into the world of the Russian scholarship here was that I came from a small country that was colonized by Russia, right? Conquered and colonized. Mm-hmm. And I think my perceptions and perspectives certainly were not necessarily aligned with many of the scholars who were working in the field. I mean, I remember interaction with Stephen Jones, who was a Russian specialist, and he was denying things that were obvious to me, such as that Russia was and in many respects is the colonial empire. From a Jordan point of view, it is a colonial empire. I think there is no question about it. And yet he and many others were arguing that Russia kind of followed a path that was unique from among the European empires and that it was not necessarily this classical colonial empire, which was mind-boggling to me. So what do you think then is the way forward then? And I think in our discussion before we started kind of the podcast, you mentioned the need to decolonize the Russian history. How do you do that?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, that is the leitmotif today in the field. And I've become, so since the war started, I'm more sympathetic to what you're saying and your view of the Russian Empire, whereas before I probably would have tended more toward the idea that Russia's colonial experience was unique. I mean, every historical experience is unique, so there's never an exact replication, and there are distinctive features about Russian imperialist expansion. I think it definitely should be called imperialist expansion or colonization, but it happens, you know, in a specifically Russian historical way, which would be the same if you're talking, you know, you would say the same thing about France or Britain or the American Empire, which supposedly exists. I mean, so there are different forms of imperialism. And I guess you had mentioned in an earlier episode the question of grand strategy and Russia's grand strategy. And I can completely sympathize with and accept your view of the Russian Empire. And but at the same time, on that question, I guess because my background comes from social and institutional, legal, administrative history, cultural history, I have a hard time seeing the Russian government acting in a coherent, consistent way. So that would be my criticism of, or that would be something I would want to bring into the question of imperialist expansion. The violence is there. I mean, there's no question. There's a wonderful book by Barbara Skinner about the conflict in, I guess it would be Eastern Ukraine now, or some of the Polish-Lithuanian territories where the Orthodox Church and the Uniate Church and the, you know, they're battling for hearts and minds for control over parishes. And this is the reign of Catherine II, who is supposed to arguably the most enlightened of all Russian monarchs ever. But the level of violence, so the violence is there no matter how you define this imperial project. But at the same time, there's so many different theaters in which the Russian Empire is operating, so many different circumstances. And the way it happens, to my mind, seems very, very tied to the local situations, and particularly to the need to define borders which are not naturally imposed. So there are a lot of specifics about Russia. In an earlier conversation with Alex, I quoted Jeffrey Hosking somewhere in one of his books where he says, you know, Russia, Britain had an empire, but Russia was an empire. So I still think there's something to that. To get back to your question, I think what we need to emphasize is the violence, the arbitrariness, the parts of Russian imperialism that stem from this absolutist monarchical political system, or what, you know, would have been called autocracy, a word that people haven't wanted to use, you know, the past few decades?
Well, let me bring our fellow panelists, I guess, Charles, who has been patiently sitting and listening to us. Charles, how are you?
Hi. Faster my voice, Sharon Lannin. Good evening from the Isle of Man. I am fine, having had a relaxing Christmas break. That's on one level. On another level, I am deeply, deeply worried about the situation with regards to the Ukrainian war. And indeed, with the situation which the West faces in the wider world. I was reading a long report on BBC News website today, a long article about the way in which Western interests have taken a real battering right around the world in 2023. It's obviously there's the Russian threat, the direct Russian threat. And if Ukraine falls, we really are in a mess. But it's other places as well. In the Sahel, in Africa, the way in which French peacekeeping forces have been ejected by a series of military coup, and who stepped in? Wagner. And it's still there, despite the death of its abysmal leader. The way in which Western views appear to count for nothing with places like Brazil, India, South Africa. I think it's a really, really very, very worrying time. And that's the situation of the war in Ukraine. I'll be blunt. I think Ukrainian strategy this year has been absolutely catastrophic. To launch their main attack in the place where the Russians were obviously strongest. If I knew that the Russian defences were strongest, blocking the way to Mariupol, just from reports on various news services, I mean, satellite pictures were published and all the rest of it, it was quite obvious that the Russians were going to put the main weight of their defensive effort blocking the way to the sea. And the Ukrainians walked into a trap, bluntly idiotic. However, moving on, thinking about the historical profession, I'll move away from Russia because I'm not an East Europeanist. I'm not a Russianist. Don't have any East European languages. But it seems to me that there is a lesson here for the historical profession. Maybe I will come over as a crusty old conservative or something. I am no fan of very traditional military and diplomatic history. My work actually ranges over a far broader range of topics. I bring in social history, I bring in economic history, I even bring in cultural history. But the fact of the matter is, I do feel that insofar as European history is concerned, and indeed a great many other histories are concerned, the historical profession has lost its way. There are too many Europeanists in British universities, and I suspect the same is true of American universities, though I can't say for certain. There are far too many people looking at things like poodle ownership in Paris, to take one example. Bluntly, what is the point? We are back in a world where military history matters, where international history matters, where diplomatic history matters. And I fear that far too many British universities, at least, are simply not equipped to deal with that anymore, because in part because to the extent they do European history at all, they've moved towards cultural topics, and in part because with the march of decolonization, European history has been set aside in favor of, for example, African history. It's not that African history doesn't matter, of course it matters. The problem is that the historical profession is not especially well equipped to deal with what is happening.
I see your point. I think when the war began in Ukraine, I might have said it on one of the podcasts, we discovered that in the state of Louisiana, where I live, we only have two people who specialized in Russian, in Russia, let me put it this way. One was a language specialist who is a Tulane, and, well, literature and language specialist in Tulane, and the other one was me, and I did more kind of history and political military history of it. And so that was kind of a weird realization that I think on the part of the university system that they've really dropped the ball on for example on the Russian studies in the wake of the collapse of Soviet Union, when it was perceived that we can move forward and kind of let the Russian specialists retire and replace them with people specializing in something else. And I think that's what you, Charles, you're referring to is kind of the field has moved in different directions since 1991, and now it kind of is a knee-jerk reaction where history is back, and it's back in a form and shape of great power politics. So there might be another knee-jerk reaction towards maybe hiring or specializing in what we can call a traditional topics. What do you think, Elise?
Well, I think that's a promising possibility. I mean, that connects to the question I raised earlier about the topics that we've been discussing throughout my career and the conclusions we've drawn. And on those questions and conclusions, I would say we gain very little in terms of being able to understand what's happening now or having insight into where Russia was going after the end of the Soviet Union. So yes, maybe the answer lies in going back to the more traditional topics, or at least that's a way forward. You were talking about ways forward. I've had another thought, Alex and Charles, about a way forward in Russian history. And Alex, this comes from you too, because you introduced me to this security history network. Our first direct interaction goes back to Utrecht, right? Ever since then, I've been wondering or asking myself, maybe the place to start with Russia. And this doesn't mean that we can change what we're doing now. I mean, I'm also worried as Charles is about what's going to happen in Ukraine militarily, and I'm worried about wavering Western support and wavering American support, all of that. So the question I'm going to mention now really has nothing to do with practical questions about what we do today. But I wonder if we pose the question in terms of this what is the term they use? Security culture orientation. And we ask ourselves, as historians, how has Russia understood its security? I mean, what does it take for Russia to feel secure? Because, and this relates to the imperialist question, because, you know, if we accept that beyond the aggression and the raw imperialism that you've highlighted, if we accept that, you know, Russia does have legitimate security interests and needs and perceptions, whether or not they're accurate, maybe the first step is to understand, okay, what are those perceptions, those perceived needs, those those feelings of vulnerability, and then maybe there's a way forward through historical study.
Charles?
I'll be blunt. I don't think there'll be any way of meeting Russia's security concerns until Russia has taken back all the territories it lost and until we have a Warsaw Pact again. I recall that shortly after the outbreak of war, a huge amount of diplomatic correspondence. It was basically a whole series of interviews with leading American statesmen, security, possibly British people as well. I can't quite remember exactly what it was. I mean, I read through it and it was page after page after page. And over again, people were saying to the Russians, "What do you want? Please, Mr. Lavrov, tell us what you want. What can we do to satisfy you? What can we do to reassure you?" And there was a void. There was nothing that we could do. It's as simple as that. I honestly believe that the Russians, at least the Putin regime, is so caught up in its nostalgia for the Soviet Union, its nostalgia for the Warsaw Pact, that nothing else will satisfy it. Perhaps that's an extremely pessimistic view.
I think so.
but nothing in this situation, nothing in this scenario encourages me to be optimistic.
I think I would agree with you, Charles, to a degree that there is clearly an imperial revanchist narrative. It's the degree to which the empire needs to, you know, they want to rebuild the empire is where we might quibble. There is no possibility of I think the Warsaw Pact being rebuilt. So let's set that aside. But Ukraine is, as Elise pointed out, is a fundamentally a security issue for Russia. I think the European empires, whether we talk about French, British, Belgian, Dutch, I think one of the unique elements, and this is what allowed the Russian historians to kind of talk about the unique Russian way, that the European empires were geographically and politically separated from the overseas dependencies. So therefore, their experiences are quite unique from Russian. I think we know that as late as 1950s and 60s, there were only few thousand, I think less than 20,000 by some studies, who of non-white foreign-born residents in the whole of British islands. I think there is a very few people from the colonies, right, quotation mark, colonies that were able to make it to the Netherlands or Belgium until even through the decolonization period. Even France might be the only unique kind of exception to this. It has the, you know, Algerian territories, Oran, Alger, Constantine, right, and it had this massive population that did increase the share of non-French residents of the French Republic, but even that was geographically separate from France proper. I think what made the Russian Empire unique was that it was politically unified into a geographically contiguous country. And what happened, therefore, is with this fall of Soviet Union, we talk about the collapse of the empire, and that creates a vision of the fear that among many Russians that the process, if it's allowed to continue, will effectively reduce Russia to the historical, right, this kind of historical Russia. And this is where I see the secession of Ukraine from Soviet Union in 1991 and more recently the turn that Ukraine takes towards a far more Western and European path. as being of a tremendous security concern to Russia, because I don't think Russia can have a place the way it envisions itself for the past 30, 40 years, with Ukraine being part of European Union, with Europe, with Ukraine being part of European landscape. I think Zbigniew Brzezinski, right, the famous, I think what he was, the U.S., the security, right, the counselor to U.S. presidents, I think he once famously observed that without Ukraine, Russia ceases to be a Eurasian empire. And we can quibble about the definition of it and details of it, but in essence, I do agree with him that Ukraine is fundamental to the Russian place in Eurasia, how Russia conceives its security. The same way as I see Georgian place in this larger narrative as being very important for the Russian presence in all of Caucasus, which is why we have a really negative development in the past decade with a rather pro-Russian government being installed. So I think Ukraine, to me, is crucial for the war in Ukraine is crucial to the outcome of this struggle. What I see is happening is Russia going through effectively a decolonization period, just like European powers went through it in 1950s and 60s. Elise, what do you think?
Well, I think that's correct. Actually, I've tried to educate myself about Ukraine more and more since the war started, and I've read and listened to lectures by Serhiy Plokhy. I'm sure you know his work. He's a Ukrainian historian at Harvard, and he says just that this is the end of the process of the collapse of the European empires. This is the last moment, and this particular situation, it's Russia. You know, it's the Russian Empire that still had clung to this imperial system and imperial status. And so, you know, if I remember correctly, and this was much earlier in the war, and I don't know how his views have evolved. I'm sure they have evolved, but you know, he seemed to think that, you know, this will happen. This collapse is inevitable. The Russian Empire in Ukraine is going to end. And, you know, it may take a while, it may be a horrific time, but it's bound to happen. But then there's the other discussion that you also mentioned about how Russia cannot be Russia without Ukraine. So, you know, which of those dynamics wins out? I don't know. I mean, I agree with Charles that right now the situation looks dire. In terms of a resolution, a clear resolution. Now, maybe, and this came up in your earlier discussions where you talked about how things might at least stabilize. And there's the example of the Korean Peninsula, you know, some sort of armistice and division that doesn't recognize these territorial gains by Russia, but just stops the fighting. And then there's the Israel-Palestine analogy that people point to. But in terms of, I know, Alex, you spoke eloquently on the need for Ukraine to recover this territory, you know, that there, and I don't know how that happens or when that happens. So ultimately, I think that could be out there as the goal, just as reunifying the Korean Peninsula may be the goal. But you know, in the interim, there may be some sort of settlement that creates a border or a demilitarized zone. So maybe at this point, that seems like the best we can hope for, because there doesn't seem to be a resolution either way militarily.
I think and this is where, and Charles, I know how pessimistic Charles is about it, but I'm a bit upbeat about it. Even in the most pessimistic scenario where Russia retains the control of eastern Ukraine, I think on a strategic level, Russia has lost, and that in long term Russia has lost. I cannot foresee any scenario in which the rest of Ukraine will be incorporated by Russia. And so even if we use the comparison with Korea, if Ukraine turns into South Korea, that's actually would be a remarkable development, especially in terms of the levels of development, economic, industrial. I am still convinced that Russia will collapse. Maybe not in the 2024, but the situation, the way the system works, I don't think it's tenable in the long run, especially with regards to dependencies. I mean, we can talk about dependencies in the Caucasus, Chechnya, Dagestan. These are drains on Russian economy with little accountability, with lawlessness to the degree that is astonishing, where the Russian federal laws effectively are not applied to entire regions. So I don't think that's sustainable in the long term. Charles.
Okay, thank you. I've been listening to all of this with great interest, of course. Take things in reverse order. First of all, my perception of the military situation. I'm worried because the Ukraine has seemingly squandered so much of the material which it was sent. And this wouldn't matter so much if the supplies were keeping on rolling in, but we no longer know if they're going to keep rolling in. And that means that those losses become very alarming. None of this means that I think that Ukraine has in and of itself lost the war. The very fact that it is still fighting nearly 2 years on constitutes a victory. In that sense, Ukraine is victorious. And it's quite clear, and I do agree with you, Alex, here, it's quite clear that the Russians have sustained an appalling defeat. I don't think they ever had the moral high ground, but they've lost whatever high ground they ever had. And they've been made to look ridiculous. So in that sense, I'm not quite as pessimistic as I might sound. I have been gravely concerned by the direction which Ukrainian strategy has taken, because if you look back to the first few months of the war, Ukraine was fighting a very agile, very imaginative, very innovative style of war, really. It was engaging in effectively in asymmetrical combat, employing drones, employing small detachments of men mounted on motorbikes and those off-road tractor things that zoom about to help shepherds round up sheep and so forth. And that seems to have been lost. And I don't know what it was. Were they carried away by a vortex of triumph? Were they pressured into it by public opinion? Was it about meeting Western expectations? But it seems to me that the battle they decided to fight by driving a Mariupol was a catastrophic decision. And it stuck them into the kind of war of attrition which they were going to find very hard to win, at least battle of attrition. Now, can I move back to an earlier point in the discussion and thinking about Russian security concerns? I am tempted to ask, what security concerns? Everything I hear has been about prestige. It's been about Russia's place in the world. If Ukraine becomes independent, is Russia going to be attacked from Ukraine? No. Is NATO ever going to attack Russia? No. NATO is a defensive organization.
But that's
all Ukraine wants. All Ukraine wants is to be left alone. Therefore, we're not talking about security concerns. We're talking about issues of prestige.
I think,
and that's a difference.
While we agree on this, Charles, that's not how Russians look at it. And again, I don't want to generalize. At least we talk about the government officials. We talk about senior officials. They don't look at NATO as a defensive alliance. They look at NATO as a security threat that is, as we've listened to them, is bent on expanding, right? And that expansion is perceived as a security threat. So while I completely agree with you, if anything, this is the thing I've argued, is that anyone who's traveled to Russia, if you leave the cities like Moscow, St. Petersburg, maybe Nizhny Novgorod, you'll be stunned by the abysmal state of the countryside. Russia has enormous space that it can take advantage of, develop, do something with it. Here's one of the interesting things, and I talk to my students, is that Russians took over Siberia in the 17th century, right? By 1648, they're on the shores of Kamchatka. So in that sense, Russia becomes a continental power almost two centuries before the United States. And yet, look what Russians have done with that continental territory. United States acquired California in 1840s. And yet, by 1900s, by mid-1950s, right, by mid-20th century, California becomes a robust, developed, vibrant space. Today, California is the largest U.S. state in terms of gross regional product, in terms of population, in terms of contribution to the American economy. And now compare that to Russian Far East, right? And that's a reflection of the reality that where the Russian government historically considered the Far East as mere an outpost, an inconsequential part of the larger economy. So if anything, Russian government should stop all obsessing about the Western threat and focus on developing in eastern provinces, eastern regions, and develop two cores, two edges, whatever you want to call it. One dealing with Europe, one dealing with the Pacific and China. Right? If there is one enormous outcome of this war is the growing reliance of Russia on China. I was looking at The Economist, and The Economist had a nice, interesting data set on China's trade with Russia. China is now the trade partner of Russia, with increased, dependency of Russia on Chinese. So how is that good for the Russian security in the long term? So this is where, for us, maybe it's inconceivable that they concern, but it doesn't mean that we can simply wish it away. If there is one thing that drives me nuts, it's reading Dmitry Medvedev's, the former Russian president, now whatever his position is, his tweets. They're borderline genocidal, irrational, and yet they reflect the viewpoints of a senior member of the Russian government. Just yesterday, he was tweeting about the need to exterminate yet again of Ukrainian population in the territories that will be taken over by the Russian. We talk about 2023, right? So I don't know. Elise, what do you think?
Well, to build upon what you said, there are a couple of things that come to mind. One, I mean, you're completely right. The way we see it and what seems rational to us is not necessarily the way they see it. Now, in terms of how they see it, Alex and I, Russia scholars, our understanding of Russia comes from Alex has a broader understanding because of his life experience, but for those of us who come to this academically or as so-called experts, the way we see Russia comes from the Europeanized Russian elite. That's our perspective, and that's the reality we've wanted to believe in. And then there's this distinction that one always makes between governments and people. But we don't really understand much about the Russian people. And that's, you know, that's been the case both in our scholarship as historians, despite the best efforts of social historians. And that's definitely, that's still the case today in terms of our understanding of how Russians think and what they're thinking. So I'm always wondering, you know, I know what I hear and what I think is based on this European identity that many educated Russians possess. So, you know, Alex's discussion about China and the possibilities for developing this Asian part of Russia, I mean, that's really interesting, and it would be wonderful if the Russian leadership would think that way. That the other issue I wanted to bring up has to do with the question of state power, Russian state power, and Alex touched on this in a slightly different way, and the way in which historically, at least, the Russian elites, and I assume the Russian people, because they originally voted for Putin, whatever we may think about the legitimacy of elections, as far as I understand, the first elections were not rigged, you know, in the way that the 2024 elections will be. Certainly they accepted his governance, you know, his coming to power, and welcomed it in many ways. So there is this historical pattern of the Russian people, quote unquote, and the Russian elites identifying their well-being with the power of the state. And that comes from this centralized, again, quote unquote, autocratic culture. That's something we don't quite understand. And, you know, that's a dynamic that we need to understand if we're going to understand what the Russian people actually might be thinking, because, you know, they appear to be accepting this situation and accepting their government, even though the people we know, Alex, the people we were connected with personally as scholars, I mean, they would always say, I don't believe anything my government tells me. Zilch, nothing, you know? So, but that's a problem too, because then they don't listen to the government. You know, they're so detached and cynical about the government that they make their way as they can, you know, in their academic lifestyle, and they're not really engaged with what may be happening in the government. And then the last thing, and then I will shut my mouth, has to do with the ability of this you guys mentioned in an earlier discussion about the ability, maybe it was Charles, about the ability of the Russian people to endure hardship and suffering. And I agree that Russia is by definition defeated already, in that Ukraine has resisted. On the other hand, I really think Russia can go on and on and on for a long time. They are masters of improvisation. They are survivors. And I don't see an end to their ability to survive this situation.
Charles?
What I've been thinking about and listening to all of this, a number of books I've read just recently on the Russian people and their view of the war. There's one by Jade McGlynn, called Russia's War. Another one, I forget who the author is, but the title's Generation Z. And we're starting to see the appearance of books which really seek to get to grips with the way in which Russia's control of the media, Putin's control of the media, and manipulation of a situation in which you have a populace who are desperately ignorant, have produced a mindset which is basically 100% behind the war. And earlier, like back in February 2022, it might have been 75% behind the war. 80% behind the war. There was this Europeanized elite. Not, of course, the people up at the top in the government, but basically the man on the Moscow omnibus, the man on the St. Petersburg omnibus, people who were educated, people who were professional, people who had aspirations, people who could see something other than what the regime was offering them. But so many of those people, good people, all of them, in many, many ways, so many of them have gone. They've left. They voted with their feet. And what we have left, alas, is this lumpen mass, which has no way of challenging the regime. It's got no basis on which to challenge the regime. It believes what it's told. And Jane McGlynn was particularly interesting. She said we'd be wrong to think about the whole of the Russian populace massing in the streets, demonstrating in favour of war. She argued that essentially the regime is actually against that sort of thing. It doesn't like activism. It prefers apathy. Apathy is easier to control because activism gets out of hand. And she actually said there's a whole range of different attitudes. There are people who are really gung-ho and want to kill every Ukrainian in sight. There are people who say basically, well, yeah, if the government says so, it must be a good idea, but they're not personally invested. There are people who are concerned, but lack the wherewithal to take that concern anywhere. They think, well, it doesn't seem to be going right. You know, why haven't we won by now? You know, why do things seem to be going wrong? You know, what's the matter? But they haven't really got the information or indeed the education to take things further. And finally, there are people who are desperately, desperately unhappy. Mothers who've lost their sons, for example, grandparents who lost their grandchildren. I mean, the war is having an impact at that level. But what do those people do? You know, they know that if they say a wrong word in a supermarket or something, you know, they'll be shipped off to somewhere extremely unpleasant for 15 years. You know, so I think that there is material now. Okay, possibly rather journalistic, you know, possibly rather too immediate, shall we say, but we are getting some sort of access to what's going on behind the scenes. And that tends to you know, bring me back to what you were saying, Elise, about the Russian people's ability to take it, if you like, to suck it up. I don't think we need to mystify that. I don't think there's something metaphysical about the Russian national character, which means that they just grin and bear it and soldier on with snow on their boots. I think it's rather a reflection of a regime which offers them no alternative information and no means of expression. But we come to the same thing.
Is the author of the book Ian Garner?
What, the Generation Z one?
Yes,
I think I'd have to look that up. The name is familiar.
Yeah, I think I read the book with the same title that discussed the Russian fascist youth. Maybe I think that's the same
it,
book.
That's yeah, it. So, and there's also one by a Russian historian called I think Medvedev of all things, which has got a very similar title.
Okay.
So it's almost identical, like the Z generation or some such.
Yeah. And I think in many respects, what I see there is what I went through as a child. I mean, the Soviet Union was also keen on mass mobilizing children and you know, kind of into this zealous patriotic organizations and having us parading. I mean, I remember when I was at the school and I was straight A student, you know what my reward was? they took us, we were selected, four of us, to be on the guard of honor in front of Lenin's statue for a week. That was the reward for being a straight A student. I think I deliberately started getting B's just not to get the honor again. I found it interesting that when you mentioned the government deliberately doesn't want this mass or demonstrations, even in support of it. I think you might have followed the news, and I certainly did, and especially on the Russian news channels, about the almost naked party in Russia, where I think a week ago, mm-hmm. right, the TV the celebrities and influencers all got together for a party in Moscow where they were all essentially naked, wore the see-through dress, and they had one might imagine was an amazing party. Except that the videos and the photos leaked out, and it sparked a remarkable backlash in which the organizers and some of the people who attended were fined. They were taken to the court, and I think Lefortovo court just a couple of days ago fined them. And the charge was mass presence that violated public order. They can't even have a party. A private party without violating the mass order. Not to mention this perception of the moral damage that this party caused at the time of war. So, but it's of course a deliberate ploy by the government to beat down any manifestation of what we might refer to as a kind of free spirit or free thinking. I don't know if the party wasn't necessarily about free thinking, but certainly it was an expression of something different. Elise, this has been a long conversation we've been having, and we're really grateful for your time. But any final thoughts on the situation in Ukraine and how it will impact Ukraine, Russia, West?
Well, I would add something to what you were saying about the almost naked party, because I've been thinking about the past few days and marveling at how TV ran, all the attention that the controversy has gotten. So on the one hand, we could say, well, that's some, like you said, evidence of a free spirit, of some sort of resistance. On the other hand, the fact that it's taken over the airwaves is something that really is beneficial to the Russian government, because rather than talking about real political issues and maybe real, civic action, what is everyone talking about? They're talking about this, free spirit or outrageous behavior, however you see it. So I wonder, I think even in those situations, the state apparatus is able to manipulate the conversation and the perception and divert people's attention from issues that might lead to some real change. So I guess, we've all been waiting for change in Russia since the end of communism, and we're still waiting. And we all jump on these moments of free spirit, as you say, and I keep waiting, so that's what I'm doing now. Waiting, hoping. We have to hope,
I think we all wholeheartedly agree with you. Thank you so much for your time. We really enjoyed this conversation. I wish you and all the listeners Happy New Year. And I do hope that 2024 will be a fruitful year full of better news and maybe more upbeat and more optimistic prospects for the future. Alex, back to you.
Well, Alex, thank you very much for that great discussion. Really interesting to hear all about that. If you happen to have any questions or thoughts that you'd like to send over to us, we'd be very grateful for them, and I can get them in front of Alex or Elise or whoever, and you can get an answer to you as part of our Napoleonic Cues episodes. The email to send anything to is napoleonicquarterly, that's all one word, @gmail.com. Well, there will be another Ukraine Quarterly along sooner or later. In the meantime, another main episode is just around the corner. So do stick around for that. But meanwhile, Happy New Year if you're listening at the start of 2024. Bye for now.